for Lions. And Wicker, you're in place. Thank you. Have all of you argued in front of our court previously? Thank you. And you've received the written instructions. Do you have any questions? The first argument will be 20 minutes per side. The yellow light in both instances will come on when you have 5 minutes remaining. We're now ready to hear People against Whitaker.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Elizabeth Griffin, registration number 22218, appearing on behalf of Nancy Whitaker. With the court's permission, I'll refer to my client by first name and her husband by his first name because it's just a lot easier to talk about the evidence that way. With competent counsel, Nancy Whitaker would not be serving the sixth year of her 10-year-to-life sentence for sexual assault on a child. The jury in Derek's case took 4 hours to acquit him. Nancy's attorney was incompetent as a matter of law because he was disciplined for reasons that reflect so poorly on his competence that the court may infer a violation. In addition to the 4 disciplinary actions that he had on his record before he was retained in this case, while representing Nancy, he admitted in April 2005 that he neglected cases and provided incompetent representation in 3 cases. 2 of them were criminal, and he was put on 2 years of disciplinary probation with suspended 90-day suspension. And then, while he was representing Nancy, he represented another sexual assault client and was later found ineffective for that representation for reasons that are really similar to what he did here. And then, after the verdict in this case, the Supreme Court suspended him for 1 year. And they were looking at cases that he was handling just before and at the beginning of his representation in this case. And what they said was, based on his handling of those cases and his career, that he had demonstrated a consistent pattern of neglect after collecting fees, that there was a theme of lack of diligence and neglect in his career, that he was dishonest about billing in one case, that he had possible cognitive issues, that his years of experience made his breach of duties more egregious. The court had a significant concern about the protection of the public, and the court made it sound as if they would have disbarred him, but that was not requested. They were concerned that he wouldn't retire because of his financial situation.
Ms. Griffin, in his decision denying the motion for a new trial, Judge Singer did not refer to the most recent disciplinary action against the lawyer that you just mentioned. Do you know why he didn't address that?
Well, I can't say for certain, but I assume he wasn't aware of it. It wasn't brought to his attention by the attorney. The decision came out after the motion for new trial was filed. And it just doesn't appear that it was brought to his attention.
Can I ask you, Ms. Griffin, while you've stopped, you've and today and in your brief laid out a long litany of issues with this counsel, and I think the trial judge had concerns as well. Don't we have to focus on, you know, in the motion for new trial, specifically what went wrong in this case? I mean, I understand there are grounds for per se ineffective, but those seem pretty limited. I mean, don't we have to look at the issue of prejudice here? I'll tell you, it seems to me that we do. And what you really haven't focused on specifically, I think there's an issue about this conflict of interest problem, about the joint representation issue. And I'd appreciate it if you would kind of focus on those specifically and tell us why a new trial is required here.
Okay. I'm not sure if the court wants to hear about the fact that these conflicts existed and weren't waived, or if I should just go straight to the prejudice.
I'd be interested in all of it.
Okay. Let's talk about why the conflicts existed and weren't waived. The court found that the dual representation was a conflict. I mean, there's really no question about that. And the court even found that there was an appearance of impropriety and that it was a close question whether it could be waived for public policy reasons. And it's my position that under the Rodriguez case, this conflict really is the rare type that couldn't be waived. And certainly, if it was going to be waived, there needed to be a real advisement well before the advisement that was given that was deficient anyway, and really advisory counsel should have been appointed. What happened here, as the court knows, is that, first of all, it was Mr. Smith's duty to bring this conflict to everyone's attention. But a month after he was retained, the prosecutor brought it up and said, "Judge, I don't like it. I don't think you should accept a waiver." And Nancy said, "Well, this is the first I've heard of it." And at that point, the judge had a duty, especially since the judge knew that this lawyer was hiding the conflict, to really make sure that she was advised. And the judge didn't advise her at all.
And what does that mean? I mean, I think I'm tracking with you. I mean, we know there were four or five different judges said something to this lady, and she kept saying, "No, I want him, I want him."
Yeah.
But I think you're telling us something different. And maybe Rodriguez or Martinez, I can't remember which one, does kind of suggest the court needs to walk through more specifically what the effects of this conflict are. Is that what you're arguing to us?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And the problem is that the court has to know something about the case to really advise about the hazards that the conflict poses for the particular defendant, which is what the record is supposed to reflect, an advisement of the hazards to you and that you understand those and that you knowingly waive them. And here, the court didn't know anything about the case. That's partly because he wasn't initially on the case, but it's also because there was no preliminary hearing. It was waived. There was no motions hearing because there were no motions filed. The record was completely undeveloped, and the court didn't learn about the circumstances of the case as it should have. What the court needed to tell Nancy was that your attorney won't be able to present evidence that will help you if it hurts Derek, and your attorney won't be able to effectively oppose joinder or oppose this deposition because AM isn't afraid of you, he's afraid of Derek. And AM wasn't traumatized by you, he was traumatized by Derek. He couldn't argue any of those things. He couldn't effectively move to keep out all of that evidence that this boy has PTSD and has nightmares and all of this that has nothing to do with his client Nancy because it has everything to do with his client Derek.
Is there any evidence that he could have presented that would be detrimental to Derek?
Well, he could have pursued a defense that would have embraced the prosecution theory and said, "Yeah, Derek's a bad person."
And how would that have been problematic? Derek was tried in another county in a separate case.
Well, it would have violated his ethical duties to his client.
Well, what about Judge Singer's rationale in denying the motion for a new trial, that the attorney's basic theory seemed to be that of Nancy's non-involvement, as opposed to the theory that Derek was more involved than Nancy? And Judge Singer concluded on that basis that perhaps there wasn't a conflict.
I don't recall that basis, but assuming that's right, the problem is that Mr. Smith chose the defense, and he can't advise Nancy about what the right defense might be in the first place, right? And even if that's the defense, even if the defense is that nothing happened, that AM made everything up and is a liar, then you certainly don't want all this evidence coming in about your husband has been abusing him for years and gave him PTSD, because that's got nothing to do with you if you don't know about it. First of all, that's not the res justi of your crime, because you weren't even dating Derek when that happened. There was no evidence even as to the stuff he was saying happened in Colorado after she came, because some of it he said happened before she came. How does that have anything to do with her?
I'm sorry, Ms. Griffin, finish your point, please.
Well, so the problem is that even when your theory is that nothing happened, well, then you've really got to keep out all this other stuff that doesn't have to do with Nancy at Nancy's trial. And in order to do that, you've got to make it clear to this judge who doesn't know the case that, "No, look, Judge, the boy is saying that it was Derek who did all this stuff to him. It was Derek who abused him in New Jersey when he was little. You shouldn't be admitting this picture of him when he's 12 and 13 years old, which is extremely prejudicial. and talk about something that happened when he was seven, allegedly, that Nancy didn't even know Derek when this boy was seven.
That would be problematic regardless of the conflict, wouldn't it? I mean, if this attorney did not raise the, didn't have a conflict and didn't raise these arguments, that would be falling below the standard of reasonable assistance.
Well, if he didn't have the conflict, yeah, then he'd really have to do all that. I mean, his problem was...
And how would that be problematic with the conflict again? I mean, for him simply in Nancy's case to say, Judge, that's not relevant in this case. How is it that his representation of Derek prohibits him ethically from doing that? I just don't understand.
Okay, on that point, on just the suppression of stuff that had to do with Derek and not her, it doesn't matter whether you call it ineffective assistance, substandard performance with an effect, or if you call it adverse effect from the conflict, you know, either way. But either way, it's a serious problem for her because the entire trial was about Derek doing worse stuff, threatening this boy, and the boy having nightmares and PTSD and all these things that don't have anything to do with her.
It seems to me, Ms. Griffin, if I can jump in here, and I'm picking up on Judge Taubman's question, I also recall the judge kind of saying, well, it looks like it was non-involvement was the defense, and the judge, if it jogs a recollection with you, the judge did in connection with, well, if it was duress, that might be a problem, but I'm not sure it was duress. And I mean, it seems to me there was some evidence that would have supported a duress. he forced me to do this to the victim, and so I did. And I'm just curious now, in terms of the advisement, was there any discussion about that, even hypothetically?
No.
Okay.
No.
And my that was a little bit vague. Any even hypothetical discussion, like for example, Nancy, if you want to allege that your husband forced you,
right,
that might cause an issue. There's no discussion about that at all.
No, absolutely not. And this last advisement, you know, that took place a week before trial, happens shortly before the deposition. So then when the boy testifies at the deposition and the court hears him say several times he forced Nancy, that he would get an angry voice and she would go along and she didn't want to do it, there still wasn't, you know, a re-advisement at that point when the court did know what the case was about. Nobody was looking out for Nancy here. This is not the way things are supposed to work.
Ms. Griffin, I know you've, and we all have asked you to address an ineffective issue with 7.5 minutes or so left. I just want to give you a little bullet point here. I would really appreciate hearing about the sufficiency argument as well when you get to it. Particularly, I have, as Ms. Gillespie will hear from me, some concerns about whether there was evidence of position of trust at the time. So I just don't want you to run out of time without addressing that, and I'd appreciate if you would find some moments to do that when you get a chance.
I might wait for a rebuttal on that, if that's okay.
Okay. Your call.
I just want to say that the felony charges pending against Mr. Smith, even though there was a special prosecutor, this was a conflict for him too. And the reason is, he set his jury trial for 1 month before Nancy's trial. Okay. Now, what would have happened if he was convicted? Well, he might have been immediately remanded to custody. He was facing up to 9 years in prison, and his license would have been immediately suspended. Automatically, meaning she would have no lawyer.
But that's not what happened. And so what is your response to Judge Singer's conclusion that the Edibles case was distinguishable because the charges against the attorney were in fact dismissed approximately 2.5 months before Nancy's trial?
Well, you know, every case presents a different fact pattern, and this doesn't fit exactly in Edibles, but Waddell is really helpful because what happens is, okay, Smith is laboring under this conflict for a good period of the time that he should be preparing her defense, and he's being investigated for the disciplinary stuff too. It gets dismissed 2.5 months before her trial, but then what does the 13th Judicial District do? They file 4 misdemeanor cases against him before her trial, when he should be doing his final trial preparation in the 2 months before her trial. He's now got 4 class 1 misdemeanors. Those carry up to 18 months in jail, and they require reporting to disciplinary counsel and an automatic an investigation of fitness. So the trial court said the misdemeanor cases weren't a significant enough conflict. Then he analogized it to this traffic case against an attorney, and that's just not the same thing at all. Because what you have here is it's like Waddell. There's a felony case, it's dismissed, but then the 13 judicial district prosecutors, who are the ones that, you know, were worried about Smith being concerned about having to curry favor with, they respond to what the special prosecutor does by filing these four charges against him that create another actual conflict for him. He doesn't tell Nancy about any of this. I mean, I don't know that the trial judge knew about any of this. I hope he didn't, because it would have been his duty to advise her if he did. Is that my yellow light?
Yes, it is.
I'm going to save my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Gillespie. I'm here representing the people of the state of Colorado today. My number is 26109. I first want to start by responding to defense counsel's comment that no one here was looking out for this particular defendant. The prosecutor and the trial court were in a very precarious position in this particular case, because there is no error if they had allowed her to go forward with a conflicted counsel. There would have been error that was reversible. If they had interfered with her right to counsel of choice, it would have been an error that would have mandated reversal. So there was a very thin line that the prosecutor and the trial court were walking here. The prosecutor brought it up at the very first meeting where the defense attorney Smith appeared with both co-defendants. The judge advised Ms. Whitaker at that point, talked about the fact, just the general dangers of having co-defendants represented by one attorney. Throughout the five different times that this defendant was advised, she was told that they would find an independent attorney to advise her specifically as to the issues involved in this particular case. She turned that down. The judge gave her 30 days to think about the advisement. Smith represented to the court that he had gone through the different conflicts. The advisement included discussing plea bargains. When the prosecutor indicated that a plea bargain had been offered to Ms. Whitaker, the judge went through that advisement with her and indicated that because that plea bargain may have had a term that she would have to testify against her husband, that was creating a conflict between her representation and her husband's representation.
Ms. Gillespie, there was indeed a detailed advisement about the effects of the possible plea offer involving Ms. Whitaker, but I don't recall that there was any specific, similarly detailed advisement about any other aspects of the joint representation. Do you think that there was?
There was on what the court did, to your question, Judge, about the actual using the word duress defense, which, you know, to all of us is obvious to some extent from the record here. He did talk about the fact that this attorney could be having privileged communications with either her or her husband, could learn information that could be hurtful or beneficial to one or the other, and he may not be able to use that information because of this triangular relationship that was going on. So I think the trial court... Go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead and finish your sentence?
So I think the trial court was trying to do it in a way that kept it general, because he wasn't privy and didn't, you know, explain to her that he didn't want to get into privileged communications between her and her attorney, but was doing his best to set up scenarios for her as to how this representation of both co-defendants could be hurtful to her. And despite all of this, being given 30 days, being offered an independent attorney to sit down and advise her, she continued to refuse and continued to express that she wanted this attorney to represent her. So I do take issue that no one was looking out for her. I think the trial court and the prosecutor were doing their very best without stepping over that line of telling her that, in their opinion, they didn't think it was a wise decision. That's not their place. Their place is to give her the information and to let her make a decision. And just as the trial court advised her, if she decided to stay with Attorney Smith and things went badly for her. She was going to be in a difficult position to then come back and claim foul. And that's exactly what happened here. As soon as the convictions came down, she decided that she wanted a new attorney and didn't even wait until sentencing.
But if I can interrupt you, Ms. Gillespie, before you get too far along, you kind of alluded to what my concern is. You yourself said, and I can understand that I'm sympathetic to the trial judge's position here. I get it. But I'm concerned with how that squares with Castro. Castro says once a potential conflict of interest becomes reasonably apparent, the attorney should inform the client of the nature of the conflict and in plain terms describe the specific ways in which the conflict may affect the attorney's ability to effectively represent the defendant. You yourself indicated the court, because it was treading on difficult water, gave a general advisement, and I think there's a pretty good argument that it was a pretty general advisement. And so maybe my question goes to, what does specific ways mean in Castro? How much does the court have to say?
I don't think Castro stands for the proposition that throughout the trial and throughout the case, any time a potential theory or defense or a different way to cross-examine a witness could be handled, that the trial judge needs to stop and re-advise this particular defendant. I mean, I think the trial court was smart to say, let me give you an independent attorney. Let me give you an attorney that can actually review the documents in this case and go through this with you. Because I think, again, the judge has to worry about, you know, do I want to get into, has the defense attorney talked to you about the, you know, duress defense here? Well, he can't ask that question. So I think when I say general, did he discuss specific theories with Ms. Whitaker? No. But what he did say is he went through privileged communications, evidence that could be beneficial or hurtful, statements from either party. So I think he was trying to capture each of the general types of information that this relationship, the problem it was posing, without then stepping one step further and getting into any privileged communications with Ms. Whitaker. And the judge expressed that concern to her, you know, without telling me what you've discussed with your attorney. And so I think this is a case of buyer's remorse. I think she went with an attorney, whether it was financial reasons or, you know, she had a confidence in him. But I think the trial court went as far as they could. And I think that, you know, the trial judges in his written order said, you know, her defense was that she wasn't a part of this, that this child or this teenager, they attacked his credibility and went with that theory during trial. And I think it's a case where now she's, you know, gotten a result that she's not happy with, and we're arguing about it here. But I think at this point, you know, I don't know what else the trial court and the prosecutor could have done in this case.
Well, what about the conflict of interest based upon the pending criminal charges against Mr. Smith?
I'm looking at the case law for the court. I think that most of the disciplinary proceedings against this attorney were over long before this particular case started.
I didn't mean to ask you about the disciplinary proceedings, just the criminal cases, the pending felony and then the pending misdemeanors.
I think the court pointed out earlier that one of them was dismissed by the special prosecutor, and I think that until the defense attorney suffers a conviction at that hands, he's presumed innocent as anybody else is. And I think that two out of the three of those cases all had to do with a business relationship he had with a livestock company. There's really even no background information on that, but two of the criminal cases that were pending, there's no evidence that Mr. Smith was even in the courtroom, that he was some sort of registered agent with those cases.
Ms. Gillespie, can you, and if I may have read this and just don't remember, why was there a special prosecutor, and who was the special prosecutor on the felony charge? Was it because of the possible conflict here?
I'm not sure. There wasn't anything in the record that addressed that.
All right. And is Ms. Griffin correct, or do you agree that it was the same prosecuting attorney at least who brought the misdemeanor charges?
Yes.
All right. Now, how do you distinguish, from forgetting the name of the case now, that the court relied and started with an M, I recall, where it was a traffic ticket, and the court said traffic ticket is very different than edibles. The misdemeanors here, as I remember it, were certainly more significant than a traffic ticket. So why, forgetting about the felony charge for a minute and a different prosecutor, we now have the same prosecutor who's brought misdemeanor charges, or a number of them, right before Ms. Whitaker's trial.
My recollection of the dates of those cases are different.
Okay.
And my understanding was that those were brought after the trial but before sentencing. I may be incorrect on that. There were a lot of dates.
I believe that the misdemeanors were actually filed, or at least some of them were filed before Ms. Whitaker's trial.
Were they? You know, again, I'm with the record and stuck with the record that we have here, and I'm by no stretch of the imagination trying to excuse Mr. Smith's behavior with not disclosing this, but I don't think that there was any requirement in any of the rules of professional conduct that required him to disclose that information. And I think any, you know, there's been no evidence offered in the trial court to show that the fact that those cases were pending were causing any conflict for Mr. Smith.
Go ahead. Ms. Gillespie, there's other issues that have been raised by the defense here with regard to the jury that was seated, with regard to the lack of a preliminary hearing, the lack of an opening statement, the lack of a defense, theory of the defense instruction. What's your position on whether those were effective assistance or denied effective assistance?
For the most part, I agree with the trial court. I mean, preliminary hearings are waived all the time, and I think when you look at whether or not those amounted to ineffective assistance of counsel, certainly some of those decisions were subpar. However, I think the trial judge is very accurate when he says that it takes each of those and says whether or not there was any prejudice that resulted from that. And the preliminary hearing was one, the decision to waive an opening statement. It does happen. You know, the second attorney, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, but the one who filed the motion for a new trial, specifically told the court that a hearing wasn't necessary and that the court could make a decision on the transcripts, and that's what the trial court did here.
He said a hearing wasn't necessary because the conduct was so egregious that anybody looking at it would conclude ineffective on its face, right?
That's a big gamble to take when you're filing a motion for a new trial, that you are going to assume that. I think that if there was additional evidence that would have supported his position, he would have asked for a hearing. My point goes back to you, Judge, is that I think a lot of these come down to trial strategy, and having not heard from Mr. Smith, on the face, I would agree with the court that a lot of this looks like poor assistance of counsel. But I think without going into the background of why some of these decisions were made, I mean, it does appear to be an exorbitant number of jurors that may or may not have been causing a problem. However, during the rest of the jury selection process, there were questions asked to the panel as a whole as to whether or not they could be fair and impartial. And the court's read enough transcripts to know that what jurors oftentimes say in questionnaires are not what is flushed out eventually. But I think that, you know, I think when a attorney who files a motion for a new trial states that he wants the decision made on the transcripts, if he had had additional information and why or why not he didn't want to put Mr. Smith in front of the trial court and let him defend his actions, I don't know. I think if the court has some concerns or is wanting more information, I think the proper remedy is to send it back down for a hearing.
You don't think that we can decide, looking at this record as a whole and these various, at least unusual approaches to defense counsel, that we can't just come to the conclusion on the record this was not reasonable representation?
No, because I think you have a trial judge who was sitting in the courtroom that says that it didn't meet.
He's looking at the same record I'm looking at.
He is, and so if it's some of this is trial strategy and things like that, I think from the factual decisions, you have to defer to the trial court on some of these, and that's where I think it's a mess. I won't lie to you, it's a mess.
And the trial court said a number of these things are rather incomprehensible. I don't think you used that word, but incomprehensible. How could you not have a theory of defense instruction?
But I think the court also pointed to an abundance of case law that talked about the fact that it still fell under the parameters of trial strategy. I mean, the trial judge says, you know, it's subpar not to file pretrial motions, but then also points out that this attorney, Smith, did in fact litigate quite well a number of issues. So it's difficult to tell from the record based here whether or not some of these decisions were in fact a strategy that he had. I mean, they say that there was no investigation and that there was no cross-examination, for instance, of Ms. Ferguson. Well, that's true when the prosecution called her, but what they neglect to state is that he then called two witnesses, including Ms. Ferguson, in his case. So I think there are questions that remain open, and I think
are we bound by the trial court's conclusion? And I'm particularly concerned about the jurors who were seated, of the lack of an opening statement, of a lack of a defense theory instruction. Are we bound by the trial court's conclusion that that could have been trial strategy, and therefore, because it could have been trial strategy, we cannot conclude that it was not reasonable representation? Are we bound by that?
I don't think you're bound by that, but I think it should cause you pause that if this court feels that way, there is a trial court judge out there who sat through the trial who feels like it could be trial strategy. And that, to me, would say that there needs to be a hearing on the issue, and it needs to be flushed out.
And you're talking about a post-conviction court, not the trial court.
Correct, a post-conviction hearing on the motion for new trial, limited to what they have filed, not a whole new reopen this, but a hearing on this motion for a new trial, despite the fact that the attorney who filed it said he didn't need it. And whether that was a bad decision or a bad gamble on his part, I do think that the trial court gave a very detailed written order and provided numerous record sites and the proper case law. And I think his call was that most of this could be attributed to some of it could be attributed to trial strategy. I disagree with the preliminary hearing, some of that stuff, even the defense opening statement, I don't think is something that is just naturally going to be assumed to be ineffective assistance of counsel. I think a lot of times defense attorneys will wait and watch the prosecution.
They will wait and defer. They won't waive entirely.
No, not usually.
Thank you.
Ms. Gillespie, I'd like to shift gears since you only got about 4 minutes left. And I would like you to address on this, because I try to keep my word too, and I said I'd ask, sufficiency of the evidence issue. I am, I'll be very candid with you, I'm very concerned as to whether there was any evidence to support a finding by a reasonable jury that there was position of trust at the time of the offense in question. Now, I hear all the evidence, there was a relationship, she was maybe called aunt or whatever else, but as I read the statute, it has to be at the time of the commission of the acts. And I really read your brief very carefully in pieces of the record, and I was having trouble finding what the evidence is you're relying on, so persuade me, what was the position of trust?
I agree with the court that it has to be at the time of the act, but I do think that the relationship between the two individuals at different times can be relevant information on that decision as to whether or not a position of trust existed at the time. And that was my purpose for giving the court these record sites that he considered these people his aunt and uncle. The mother of the victim testified that they would call down and ask these boys, the family, the kids, to come up and spend the weekend. I think it is reasonable for the jury to assume that if these kids are up with them at a different location or at their trailer and something had gone wrong or somebody had gotten hurt, that those would have been the two individuals that would have called for paramedics or sought help. And I think that this overall relationship between these family friends that were close enough for this type of for the terms of aunt and uncle, and that the invitation, and I think I cited to the case, the Duncan case, which talks about upon taking the victim to the defendant's home where the two of them were to be alone, in this case it was alone with the co-defendants or with the other children, that this woman assumed responsibility for the welfare and supervision of this individual to and from the house.
But was there any evidence that Nancy invited the victim over? I know there was evidence that Derek did.
I don't remember, to be honest with the court specifically. I know in a lot of the child's or the teenager's responses, he referred to his aunt and uncle in the plural and was not necessarily specifically clear as to who made the phone call, but I don't think that necessarily matters if, you know, if it's her husband that's calling and inviting the children up and she's another adult that's present in the house, and based on the nature of the relationship as this child's mother describes it and what she expected from these two individuals, I think there is, when you consider the light, you know, the evidence in the light most favorable to the people at that point, that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that there was a position of trust.
So you, just to make sure I think I'm tracking with you, your position is based on this relationship, a reasonable jury could have inferred that at the time, you know, they were in that position.
And especially because these children were at the house without their parents. You know, they were there for a weekend, not just stopping in for an hour to pick something up, but were oftentimes there for the weekend with these two adults. I think it was enough for the jury to assume that and find that.
Thank you very much.
The court doesn't have any other questions. That's all I have.
On the position of trust issue, I don't believe there was any evidence that Nancy ever invited the boy over. The evidence was that Derek would call and Derek would come pick him up. He was 15 for at least two, but probably all three of the incidents he accused Nancy of, because he said even the first one he was in eighth grade and he turned 15 one month into the eighth grade. He was babysitting for their kids.
Well, if I can interrupt you, Ms. Griffin, because yeah, I know you have very little time. On that, was he babysitting on all three occasions, or at least one, I think?
The first one.
Is that right? And is that, I've really struggled with this issue, is the babysitting enough? I mean, my kids are now a little bit older, but when I've had a babysitter over, I would presume if a 14-year-old child comes to my house to babysit, that I, as the person retaining that babysitter, have some responsibility for that babysitter's care in my home. Is this babysitting relationship enough?
It's not. Because what the statute requires is that you are charged with the responsibility for that person's welfare or supervision. And what you're doing is you're leaving the house and you're trusting that person to take care of your child. So, yeah, I mean, you feel like you have some sort of a duty toward your babysitter, but it's not what the statute's talking about. I don't think the language can be read that way. And the boy did not claim that he called Nancy his aunt. He talked about her as Derek's wife. It was his mom who said he called her aunt. The standard of review for the trial court's determination that there wasn't enough prejudice is de novo. And that's in the Strickland case and also the Tenth Circuit case that I cited in my opening brief. You don't have to defer to the court's findings. There's more than enough evidence here to reverse. I will see this through. I will file the 35C that you have in your flat file if I have to. And if it takes three more years, but a lot of resources have already gone into this case, and there's no reason to remand this case for a hearing.
Ms. Griffin, let me ask you, I certainly understand that with regard to the issue of prejudice, that it's de novo. To what extent, if the trial court finds that this accumulation of questionable representation did not fall below the standard of reasonable assistance, to what extent are we bound by that?
I don't think you're bound by that at all. I mean, the question of whether particular acts fall below the standard is a legal question, I think. And Strickland says that both prongs are de novo. So I think that answers your question.
Ms. Griffin, just to clarify, if there's a conflict of interest, then the normal Strickland prejudice prong doesn't apply. Isn't that correct?
Oh, right. Then it's just that the representation was adversely affected. And so I think if you go on the conflict ground, you can just rely on the fact that Mr. Smith didn't do anything a defense lawyer would do in this case, that he didn't present a defense. He didn't give the opening or the preliminary hearing or the defense theory or the cross-examination or gave the closing where he suggested maybe she was guilty and raised the question of why she didn't testify and what does that mean. I didn't get to talk about the deposition, and I really wanted to because I think that's a huge issue. Mr. Smith didn't point out that he was 15 for at least two, if not three, of these allegations. The statute says this only applies if you're less than 15. Rule 15 does not apply because Rule 15 specifically requires the defendant to be present at the deposition. So there's no confrontation issue with Rule 15. And in fact, one of the cases cited in the answer brief, the Falk case, says the primary purpose of Rule 15 is to safeguard confrontation rights of the accused and limit deposition testimony to the narrowly defined situation of unavailability. They did not establish he was under 15 or that he was unavailable. Mr. Smith didn't do his job there either. This is not an abuse of discretion standard because of the confrontation violation. Craig and Mosley say that when the legislature specifically delineates the showing that has to be made to violate confrontation, that has to be strictly complied with. So that's de novo review. I would ask the court to vacate Ms. Whitaker's conviction for insufficient evidence or to reverse it.
Thank you, counsel. Your arguments were quite helpful. The case is now submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. Thank you for the time and effort you put into this one.